This is Audible.
The Girl in the Ice. Detective Erica Foster crime thriller novel, book 1. Written by Robert Brinzer. Narrated by Jan Kramer. Prologue. The pavement glittered in the moonlight as Andrea Douglas Brown hurried up the deserted high street. Her high heels click-clacked in the quiet, frequently breaking rhythm, a result of all the vodka she'd consumed. The January air was sharp, and her bare legs stung from the cold. Christmas and New Year had been and gone, leaving a cold, aseptic void. Shop windows slid past, bathed in darkness broken only by a grimy off-license under a flickering streetlight. An Indian man sat inside, hunched in the glow of his laptop, but didn't notice as she stalked past. Andrea was so fueled by anger, so intent on leaving the pub behind, that she only questioned where she was going when the shop windows were replaced by large houses set back from the pavement. A skeleton of elm tree branches stretched above, vanishing into the starless sky. She stopped and leant against a wall to catch her breath. Blood roared through her body, and the icy air burned as she pulled it into her lungs. Turning back, she saw she'd come quite far and was halfway up the hill. The road stretched away behind, a slick of treacle bathed in sodium orange with the train station at its base, which was shuttered in darkness. The silence and the cold pressed down on her. The only movement was the stream of vapour as her breath hit the freezing air. She tucked her pink clutch bag under her arm, and satisfied no one was around, lifted the front of her tiny dress and retrieved an iPhone from her underwear. The Swarovski crystals on the cover glittered lazily under the orange streetlights. The screen showed there was no signal. She cursed, tucked it back into her underwear and unzipped the tiny pink clutch. Nestling inside was an older iPhone. It too had Swarovski bling, but several of its crystals were missing. It too showed no signal. Panic climbed in Andrea's chest as she looked around. The houses were set back from the road, tucked behind tall hedges and iron gates. If she could reach the crest of the hill, she'd probably get reception. And screw it, she thought, she would call her father's driver. She'd think of an explanation why she was south of the river. She buttoned up her tiny leather jacket, wrapped her arms over her chest and set off up the hill, the old iPhone still cradled in her hand like a talisman. The sound of a car engine rumbled behind and she turned her head, squinting into the headlights, feeling even more exposed as the bright light played over her bare legs. Her hopes that it was a taxi were dashed when she saw the roof of the car was low and there was no for-hire sign. She turned away and carried on walking. The sound of the car engine grew louder, and the headlights were on top of her, casting a large circle of light on the pavement in front. A few more seconds passed, but the lights were still on her. She could almost feel their heat. She glanced back into the glare. The car slowed and crawled along a few feet behind. She felt furious when she realized whose car it was. With a flick of her long hair, she turned back and carried on walking. The car accelerated a little, drawing level. The windows were tinted black. A sound system boomed and fizzed, tickling her throat, making her ears itch. She stopped abruptly. The car came to a halt seconds later, then reversed the few feet back so the driver's window was now level with her. The sound system fell silent. The engine hummed. Andrea leaned over and peered at the inky glass of the tinted window, but only her face reflected back. She leant down and tried the door, but it was locked. She banged on the window with the flat of her pink clutch bag and tried the door again.
"I'm not playing games. I meant what I said back there," she shouted. "Either open the door or...
The car remained motionless, its engine humming. "Or what?" it seemed to say. Andrea tucked her bag under her arm, gave the tinted glass the finger and stalked away, climbing the last of the hill to its crest. A huge tree straddled the edge of the pavement, and putting its thick trunk between her and the car's headlights, she checked the phone again, holding it out above her head for a signal. The sky was starless, and the browny-orange cloud seemed so low that her outstretched arm might brush against it. The car slowly inched forward and came to a halt beside the tree. Fear began to trickle through Andrea's body. Staying in the shadow of the tree, she scanned her surroundings. Thick hedges lined the pavements on both sides of the road, which stretched away up ahead into a blur of suburban gloom. Then she spied something opposite, an alleyway running between two large houses. She could just make out a small sign which read, "Dulwich, 1¼". "Catch me if you can," she murmured. She took a breath and made to run across the road, but caught her foot on one of the thick tree roots bulging up under the pavement. Pain shot through her ankle as it folded under her. She lost balance, her clutch bag and phone skidding away as her hip hit the corner of the curb and she tumbled into the road, her head hitting the tarmac with a hollow thud. She lay dazed in the glare of the car headlights. They blinked off, plunging her into darkness. She heard a door open and tried to get up, but the road under her lurched and spun. Legs came into view. Blue jeans. A pair of expensive trainers blurred and became four. She put out her arm, expecting the familiar figure to help her up. But instead, in a swift move, a leather-gloved hand clamped over her nose and mouth. The other arm encircled her upper arms, pinning them against her body. The glove's leather was soft and warm against her skin, but the power and strength of the fingers inside shocked her. She was yanked up, dragged swiftly to the rear door and slung inside the car, landing lengthways on the back seat. The cold behind her extinguished as the door slammed shut. Andrea lay in shock, not quite comprehending what had just happened. The car shifted as the figure climbed into the front passenger seat and closed the door. The central locking clicked and whirred. Andrea heard the glove compartment open, a rustle, and then it was snapped shut. The car swayed as the figure clambered through the gap in the front seats and sat down hard on her back, pushing the air from her lungs. Moments later, a thin plastic strip encircled her wrists, pulling them tight behind her back, biting into her skin. The figure shifted down her body, quick and lithe, muscular thighs now pressing on her tied wrists. The pain in her twisted ankle intensified as thick tape was unfurled with a juddering sound and her ankles were bound together. An overpowering smell of a pine tree air freshener mixed with a coppery tang, and she realized her nose was bleeding. A flash of anger gave Andrea a surge of adrenaline, sharpening her mind.
"What the fuck are you doing?" she started. "I'll scream. You know how loud I can scream."
But the figure shifted round, knees now on her back, forcing the air out of her. A shadow moved in the corner of her eye, and something hard and heavy came down on the back of her head. Fresh pain and stars burst in front of her eyes. The arm rose, and again came crashing down, and then everything went black. The road remained silent and empty, as the first specks of snow began to fall, twirling lazily to meet the ground. The car, sleek with its tinted windows, pulled away almost soundlessly and slid off into the night. Chapter 1 Lee Kinney emerged from the small end terrace house where he still lived with his mother and stared up the high street at the blanket of white. He pulled a packet of cigarettes from his trackies and lit up. It had snowed all weekend and was still falling, purifying the churn of footprints and tire tracks already on the ground. Forest Hill train station was silent at the foot of the hill. The Monday morning commuters who usually surged past him, bound for offices in central London, were probably still tucked up in the warm, enjoying an unexpected morning in bed with their other halves. Lucky bastards. Lee had been unemployed since leaving school 6 years ago. But the good old days of languishing on the dole were over. The new Tory government was cracking down on the long-term unemployed, and Lee now had to work full-time for his dole. He'd been given a fairly cushy work placement as a council gardener at the Horniman Museum, just a 10-minute walk from his house. He'd wanted to stop home this morning like everyone else, but he'd heard nothing from Job Centre Plus to say that work was cancelled. In the blazing row that had followed, his mother had said if he didn't show up, his dole would be stopped and he'd have to find somewhere else to live. There was a bang on the front window, and his mother's pinched face appeared shooing him away. He gave her the finger and set off up the hill. Four pretty teenage girls were coming towards him. They wore the red blazers, short skirts and knee-high socks of Dulwich School for Girls. They chatted away excitedly in their plummy accents about how they'd been turned away from school while simultaneously swiping at their iPhones, the signature white headphone wire swinging against blazer pockets. They crowded the pavement en masse and didn't part when Lee reached them, so he was forced to step down off the curb into a murky slush left by the road gritter. He felt icy water seep into his new trainers and shot them a dirty look, but they were too absorbed in their tribal gossip, screaming with laughter. "Stuck up rich bitches," he thought. As he reached the brow of the hill, the clock tower of the Horniman Museum appeared through the bare branches of the elm trees. Snow had spattered against its smooth yellow sandstone bricks, sticking like clumps of wet toilet tissue. Lee turned right onto a residential street which ran parallel to the iron railings of the museum grounds. The road climbed sharply, the houses becoming grander. As he reached its summit, he stopped for a moment to catch his breath. Snow flew into his eyes, scratchy and cold. On a good day, you could see London spread out from here, stretching away for miles down to the London Eye by the Thames. But today thick white cloud had descended, and Lee could only just make out the imposing sprawl of the Overhill housing estate on the hill opposite. The small gate in the iron railings was locked. The wind was now blowing horizontally, and Lee shivered in his trackies. A miserable old git was in charge of the gardening crew. Lee was supposed to wait for him to show up and let him in, but the street was empty. He looked around to make certain, and then scaled the small gate into the museum grounds, taking a thin pathway between tall evergreen hedges. Sheltered from the shrieking wind, the world around him fell eerily silent. The snow was laying fast and rapidly refilled his crunching footprints as he made his way through the hedgerows. The Horniman Museum in its grounds covered 17 acres, and the sheds for gardening and maintenance were set right at the back, against a high wall with a curved top. Everywhere was a dazzling blur of white, and Lee lost his bearings, emerging deeper than he had expected in the gardens, beside the orangery. The ornate wrought iron and glass building took him by surprise. He doubled back, but after a few minutes was again in unfamiliar territory, finding himself at a fork in the path. "How many times have I walked through these bloody gardens?" he thought. He took the path to the right, leading into a sunken garden. White marble cherubs posed on snowy brick plinths. The wind gave a low howl as it blew among them. And as Lee passed, it felt as if the blank, milky little eyes of the cherubs were watching him. He stopped and held his hand up to his face against the onslaught of snow, trying to work out the quickest way to the visitor's centre. The garden maintenance crew weren't usually allowed in the museum, but it was freezing and the cafe could be open, and screw it, he would warm up like any other normal human being. His phone buzzed in his pocket, and he pulled it out. It was a text message from the Job Centre Plus saying that, due to adverse weather, he would not be required to attend his work placement. He stuffed it back in his pocket. The cherubs all seemed to have their heads turned towards him. Were they facing him before? He imagined their pearly little heads slowly moving, tracking his progress through the garden. He shook away the thought and hurried past the blank eyes, concentrating on the snow-covered ground, and emerged into the quiet of a clearing around a disused boating lake. He stopped and squinted through the whirling flakes. A faded blue rowing boat sat in the centre of a pristine oval of snow that had settled on the frozen lake. At the opposite end of the lake was a tiny decaying boat shed, and Lee could just make out the cover of an old rowing boat under its eaves. Snow was seeping into his already wet trainers, and despite his jacket the cold was spreading around his ribs. He was ashamed to realise that he actually felt scared. He needed to find his way out of here. If he doubled back through the sunken garden, he could find the path around the perimeter and emerge onto London Road. The petrol garage would be open, and he could buy more fags and some chocolate. He was about to turn back when a noise broke the silence. It was tinny and distorted, coming from the direction of the boat shed.
"Hey, who's there?"
he shouted, his voice emerging high-pitched and panicky. It was only when the noise ceased, and seconds later began to repeat, that Lee realised it was the ringtone from a mobile phone, and could be coming from one of his co-workers. Because of the snow, he couldn't tell where the path ended and the water began, so sticking close to the band of trees that lined the edge of the boating lake, Lee carefully made his way round towards the sound of the ringtone. It was a desperately light tune, and as he drew nearer, he could hear that it was coming from the boat shed. He reached the low roof, and, ducking down, saw a glow illuminating the gloom from behind the tiny boat. The ringtone stopped, and seconds later the light went out. Lee was relieved it was just a phone. Druggies and dossers regularly scaled the walls at night, and the gardening crew was always finding empty wallets, dumped after the cash and cards were removed, used condoms and needles. The phone had probably been dumped. But why dump a phone? Surely you'd only dump a really crappy phone, thought Lee. He circled the little boathouse. The posts of a tiny jetty poked through the snow, and the jetty continued under the low roof of the boat shed. Where the snow couldn't reach, Lee could see the wood was rotten. He eased along the jetty, ducking down under the eaves of the low roof. The wood above his head was rotten and splintered, and cobwebs hung in wisps. He was now beside the rowing boat, and could see that on the other side of the shed, lying on a little wooden ledge, was an iPhone. Excitement rose in his chest. He could sell an iPhone down the pub, no probs. He gave the rowing boat a shove with his foot, but it didn't budge. The water was frozen solid around it. He passed its bow, stopping at the opposite end of the jetty. Crouching on his knees, he leaned over, and using the sleeve of his coat, he cleared away a powdery layer of snow, exposing thick ice. The water underneath was very clear, and down in the depths, he could just make out two fish, mottled with red and black, swimming lazily. A string of tiny bubbles rose up from them, reached the underside of the ice, and rolled away in opposite directions. The phone started to ring again, and he jumped, almost slipping off the end of the jetty. The cheesy ringtone bounced around inside the roof. He could see the illuminated iPhone clearly now against the opposite wall of the boat shed, lying on its side on a lip of wood just above the frozen waterline. It had a sparkly jewelled case. Lee went to the rowing boat and swung a leg over. He placed his foot on the wooden seat and tested his weight, still keeping the other foot on the jetty. The boat didn't budge. He swung his other leg over, climbing into the boat. But even from here, the iPhone was still out of his reach. Spurred on by the thought of folded banknotes thick in the pocket of his trackies, Lee hooked his leg over the opposite side of the boat and tentatively placed his foot on the ice. Holding onto the edge of the boat, he pressed down, risking a wet foot. The ice held strong. He stepped out of the boat and placed his other foot on the ice, listening for the telltale squeaking sound of tension and weakness. Nothing. He took a small step, and then another. It was like walking on a concrete floor. The eaves of the wooden roof slanted down. To reach the iPhone, Lee was going to have to get down on his haunches. As he squatted down, the light from its screen illuminated the inside of the boat shed. Lee noticed a couple of old plastic bottles and bits of rubbish poking up through the ice. Then something which made him stop. It looked like the tip of a finger. His heart racing, he reached out and gently squeezed it. It was cold and rubbery. Frost clung to the fingernail, which was painted a deep purple. He pulled the sleeve of his coat over his hand and rubbed at the ice around it. The light from the iPhone cast the frozen surface in a murky green, and underneath he saw a hand reaching up to where the finger poked through the ice. What must have been an arm vanished away into the depths. The phone stopped ringing and was replaced by a deafening silence. And then he saw it. Directly underneath where he crouched was the face of a girl. Her milky brown, swollen eyes stared at him. Blankly. A clump of dark hair was fused to the ice in a tangle. A fish swam lazily past, its tail brushing against the girl's lips, which were parted as if she were about to speak. Lee recoiled with a yell and leapt up, his head crushing against the low roof of the boathouse. He bounced off and landed back on the ice, legs sliding away under him. He lay for a moment, stunned. Then he heard a faint squeaking, cracking sound. Panicking, he kicked and scrabbled, trying to get up, to get as far away from the dead girl as he could, but his legs slid away under him again. This time he plunged through the ice into the freezing water. He felt the girl's limp arms tangling with his, her cold, slimy skin against his. The more he fought, the more their limbs became intertwined. The cold was sharp, absolute. He swallowed foul water and kicked and flailed. He somehow managed to heave himself away to the edge of the rowing boat. He heaved and retched, wishing that he'd reached that phone, but his thoughts of selling it were gone. All he wanted now was to call for help. Chapter 2 Erica Foster had been waiting for half an hour in the grubby reception area of Lewisham Road Police Station. She shifted uncomfortably on a green plastic chair, one of a row bolted to the floor. The seats were faded and shiny, polished by years of anxious, guilty asses. Through a large window overlooking the car park, the ring road, a grey office tower and the sprawling shopping centre fought a battle for visibility in the blizzard. A trail of melted slush ran diagonally from the main entrance to the front desk, where the desk sergeant sat, regarding his computer with bleary eyes. He had a large, jowly face and was absently picking at his teeth, pulling out a finger to inspect the findings before popping it back in his mouth. "Governor shouldn't be long," he said. His eyes moved down Erica's body, taking in her thin frame, clad in faded blue jeans, woolen jumper, and a purple bomber jacket. His gaze came to rest on the small suitcase on wheels at her feet. She glared back at him. And they both looked away. The wall beside her was a mess of public information posters. "Don't be a victim of crime," declared one, which Erica thought was a pretty stupid thing to put up in the reception area of an outer London nick. A door beside the front desk buzzed, and Chief Superintendent Marsh came into the reception area. His close-cropped hair had greyed in the years since Erica had last seen him. But despite his exhausted face, he was still handsome. Erica got up and shook his hand. "DCI Foster, sorry to keep you. Was your flight okay?" he said, taking in what she was wearing.
"Delayed, sir, hence the civvies," she replied apologetically.
"This bloody snow couldn't come at a worse time," said Marsh, adding, "Desk Sergeant Wolf, this is DCI Foster. She's joining us from Manchester. I'll need you to assign her a car ASAP."
"Yes, sir," nodded Wolf.
"And I'll need a phone," added Erica. "If you could find something older, preferably with actual buttons, I hate touch screens."
"Let's get started," said Marsh. He swiped his ID card and the door buzzed and clicked open.
"Snotty cow," murmured Wolf,
when the door had closed behind them.
Erica followed Marsh down a long, low corridor. Phones rang and uniformed officers and support staff streamed by in the opposite direction, their pasty January faces tense and urgent.
A fantasy football league pinned up on the wall slid past, and seconds later, an identical pinboard held rows of photos with the heading, "Killed in the Line of Duty." Erica closed her eyes, only opening them when she was confident she had passed. She nearly crashed into Marsh, who had stopped at a door marked Incident Room. She could see through the half-open blinds of the glass partition that the room was full. Fear crawled up her throat. She was sweating under her thick jacket. Marsh grabbed the door handle. "Sir, you were going to brief me before," started Erica.
"No time," he said.
Before Erica had a chance to respond, he had opened the door and indicated she should go first. The incident room was large and open plan, and the 24 officers fell silent, their expectant faces bathed in the harsh strip lighting. The glass wall partitions on either side faced onto corridors, and along one side there was a bank of printers and photocopiers. Tracks had been worn into the thin carpet tiles in front of these, and between the desks to whiteboards lining the back wall. As Marsh strode to the front, Erica quickly stowed her suitcase by a photocopier which was churning out paper. She perched on a desk.
"Morning, everyone," said Marsh. "As we all know, 23-year-old Andrea Douglas Brown was reported missing 4 days ago, and what has followed has been a media shitstorm. Just after 9 o'clock this morning, the body of a young girl matching Andrea's description was found at the Horniman Museum in Forest Hill. Preliminary ID is from a phone registered to Andrea, but we still need a formal ID. We've got forensics on their way now, but it's all being slowed down by the bloody snow."
A phone started to ring. Marsh paused. It carried on ringing.
"Come on, people, this is an incident room. Answer the bloody phone."
An officer at the back snatched it up and started to speak quietly.
"If the ID is correct, then we're dealing with the murder of a young girl linked to a very powerful and influential family, so we need to stay far ahead on this one. The press, you name it, asses are on the line."
The day's newspapers lay on the desk opposite Erica. The headlines screamed out, "Daughter of Top Labour Peer Vanishes," and "Andy Kidnap Terror Plot." The third was the most striking, with a full-page picture of Andrea under the headline, "Taken."
"This is DCI Foster. She's joining us from the Manchester Metropolitan Police," finished Marsh.
Erica felt all eyes in the room turn to her.
"Good morning, everyone. I'm pleased to be..."
started Erica. But an officer with greasy black hair interrupted.
"Gov, I've been on the Douglas Brown case as a missing person and..." "And what, DCI Sparks?"
asked Marsh.
"And my team is working like clockwork. I'm following up several leads. I'm in contact with the family. DCI Foster has vast experience working on sensitive murder cases. But..."
"Sparks, this isn't a discussion. DCI Foster will now be taking the lead on this. She'll be hitting the ground running, but I know you will give her your best," said Marsh.
There was an awkward silence. Sparks sat back in his chair and regarded Erica with distaste. She held his gaze and refused to look away. Marsh went on.
"And it's mouths shut, everyone. I mean it. No media, no gossip, okay?"
The officers murmured in agreement.
"DCI Foster, my office."
Erica stood in Marsh's top floor office as he searched through piles of paperwork on his desk. She glanced out of the window, which afforded a more commanding view of Lewisham. Beyond the shopping centre and train station, uneven lines of red brick terraced houses stretched towards Blackheath. Marsh's office deviated from the normal order of a chief superintendent. There were no model cards lined along the windowsill, no family photos angled on the shelves. His desk was a mess of paperwork piled high, and a set of shelves by the windows seemed to be used as an overflow crammed with bulging case files, unopened post, old Christmas cards and curling post-it notes covered in his small, spidery handwriting. In one corner, his ceremonial uniform and hat lay draped over a chair, and on top of the crumpled trousers, his BlackBerry winked red as it charged. It was a strange mix of teenage boy's bedroom and high authority. Marsh finally located a small padded envelope and handed it to Erica. She tore the edge off and pulled out the wallet with her badge and ID. "So I suddenly go from zero to hero," she said, turning the badge over in her hand.
"This isn't about you, DCI Foster. You should be pleased," said Marsh, moving around and sinking into his chair.
"Sir, I was told in no uncertain terms that when I returned to service, I'd be put on administrative tasks for 6 months minimum."
Marsh indicated she should take the seat opposite. "Foster, when I called you, this was a missing person case. Now we're looking at murder. Do I need to remind you who her father is?"
"Lord Douglas Brown, wasn't he one of the main government contractors for the Iraq War, at the same time as serving in the cabinet?"
"This isn't about politics."
"Since when have I cared about politics, sir?"
"Andrea Douglas Brown went missing on my patch. Lord Douglas Brown has exerted enormous pressure. He's a man of influence who can make and break careers. I've got a meeting with the Assistant Commissioner and someone from the bloody Cabinet Office later this morning."
"So this is about your career?"
Marsh shot her a look. "I need an ID on this body and a suspect. Fast."
"Yes, sir."
Erica hesitated.
"Can I ask, why me? Is the plan to throw me in first as potential fall guy, then Sparks gets to clean up the mess and look the hero? 'Cause I deserve to know if..."
"Andrea's mother is Slovak, and so are you. I thought it might help things to have an officer her mother can identify with."
"So it's good PR to put me on the case?"
"If you want to look at it like that. I also know what an extraordinary police officer you are. Recently you've had troubles, yes, but your achievements far outshine what has..."
"Don't give me the shit sandwich, sir," said Erica.
"Foster, the one thing you've never mastered is the politics of the force. If you'd done that, we might be sitting on opposite sides of this conversation right now."
"Yeah, well, I have principles," said Erica, giving him a hard stare. There was silence.
"Erica, I brought you in because I think you deserve a break."
"Don't talk yourself out of the job before you've begun."
"Yes, sir," said Erica.
"Now get over to the crime scene. Report back to me the second you have information. If it is Andrea Douglas Brown, we'll need a formal ID from the family."
Erica got up and went to leave. Marsh went on, his voice softer. "I never got the chance at the funeral to say how sorry I was about Mark. He was an excellent officer and a friend."
"Thank you, sir."
Erica looked at the carpet. It was still difficult to hear his name. She willed herself not to cry. Marsh cleared his throat and his professional tone returned.
"I know I can rely on you to reach a swift conviction on this. I want to be kept posted every step of the way."
"Yes, sir," said Erica.
"And DCI Foster,
sir?"
"Lose the casual gear."
Chapter 3. Erica found the women's locker room and worked fast, changing into a forgotten but familiar ensemble of black trousers, white blouse, dark sweater, and long leather jacket. She was stuffing her civilian clothes into a locker when she noticed a crumpled copy of the Daily Mail at the end of one of the long wooden benches. She pulled it towards her and smoothed it out. Under the headline, "Daughter of Top Labour Peer Vanishes," was a large picture of Andrea Douglas Brown. She was beautiful and polished, with long brown hair, full lips and sparkling brown eyes. Her skin was tanned, and she wore a skimpy bikini top, shoulders back, to accentuate her full breasts. She stared into the camera with an intense, confident gaze. The photo had been taken on a yacht, and behind her the sky was a hot blue, and the sun sparkled on the sea. Andrea was being embraced from either side by wide, powerful male shoulders, one taller and one shorter. The rest of whoever they were had been cropped out. The Daily Mail described Andrea as a minor socialite, which Erica was sure Andrea wouldn't enjoy if she could read it, but it refrained from calling her Andy, as the other tabloids had done. The paper had spoken to her parents, Lord and Lady Douglas Brown, and to her fiancé, who had all pleaded for Andrea to get in contact with them. Erica scrabbled in her leather jacket and found her notebook, still there after all these months. She noted down the name of the fiancé, a Giles Osborne, and wrote, "Did Andrea run away?" She looked at it for a moment, then scrubbed it out ferociously, tearing the paper. She tucked the notebook in the back of her trousers and went to put her ID in the other free pocket, but paused, feeling it in her hand for a moment, its familiar weight, the leather case cover worn into a curve after years resting against her buttock in the back pocket of her trousers. Erica went to a mirror above a row of sinks, flipped open the leather case, and held it out in front of her. The ID photo showed a confident woman, blonde hair swept back, staring into the camera defiantly. The woman looking back at her, holding the ID, was scrawny and pallid. Her short blonde hair stuck up in tufts, and grey was showing at the roots. Erica watched her shaking arm for a moment, then flipped the ID closed. She would put in a request for a new photo. Chapter 4. Desk Sergeant Wolf was waiting in the corridor when Erica emerged from the women's locker room. He waddled along beside her, noticing she was a full head taller than him. "Here's your phone, it's all charged and ready to go," he said, handing her a clear plastic bag containing a phone and charger. "A car will be ready for you after lunch."
"And you've nothing with buttons,"
snapped Erica, when she saw a smartphone through the plastic. "It's got an on-off button," he snapped back. "When my car arrives, could you put this in the boot?" she said, indicating her suitcase on wheels. She moved past him and through the door of the incident room. Conversation fell quiet when she entered. A short, plump woman approached her.
"I'm Detective Moss. We're just trying to sort you an office."
The woman had wiry red hair, and her face was so spluttered with freckles that they grouped together in blotches. She went on, "All the info is going up on the boards as it comes in, and I'll have hard copies put in your office when..." "A desk is fine," said Erica. She went over to the whiteboards, where there was a large map of the Horniman Museum grounds, and underneath, a CCTV image of Andrea. "That's the last known picture of her, taken at London Bridge Station, boarding the 8:47 p.m. train to Forest Hill," said Moss, following. In the CCTV photo, Andrea was stepping up into the train carriage with a shapely bare leg. Her face was fixed with an angry expression. She was dressed to the nines in a tight leather jacket over a short black dress, wearing pink high heels and carrying a matching clutch bag. "She was alone when she boarded the train?" asked Erica. "Yes, I've got the CCTV video here that we took the image from," said Moss, grabbing a laptop and coming back over. She balanced it on a pile of files and maximized a video window. They watched the time-lapse video, a view of the train platform taken side-on. Andrea walked across into shot and into the train carriage. It only lasted a few seconds, so Moss placed it on a loop. "She looks really pissed off," said Erica.
"Yeah, like she's off to give someone a piece of her mind," agreed Moss.
"Where was her fiancé?"
"He's got a watertight alibi. He was at an event in central London."
Several more times they watched Andrea move across the platform and into the train. She was the only person in the video. The rest of the platform was empty.
"This is our skipper, Sergeant Crane," said Moss,
indicating a young guy with close-cropped blonde hair, who was simultaneously on the phone, searching through files and shoving a whole Mars bar in his mouth. He attempted to swallow as much of it as he could. Out of the corner of her eye, Erica saw Sparks put the phone down. He pulled on his coat and made for the door.
"Where are you going?"
she asked.
Sparks stopped and turned. "Forensics just gave us the okay to go down to the crime scene. We need a fast ID in case you'd forgotten, ma'am."
"I'd like you to stay here, Sparks. Detective Moss, you're with me today, and you? What's your name?"
she asked a tall, handsome black officer, who was taking a call at a desk nearby.
"Detective Peterson," he said, covering the phone.
"Okay, Detective Peterson, you're with me too."
"What am I supposed to do then, just sit here twiddling my thumbs?" demanded Sparks.
"No, I need access to all CCTV covering the Horniman Museum and surrounding streets."
"We've got it," he interrupted.
No, I want you to expand your window to everything in the 48 hours leading up to Andrea's disappearance and everything since. And I want a door-to-door around the museum. I also need anything and everything you can get about Andrea. Family, friends, pull bank details, medical and phone records, email and social media. Who liked her? Who hated her? I want to know everything. Did she have a computer, a laptop? She must have had, and I want it.
I was told we couldn't have her laptop. Lord Douglas Brown was very specific, started Sparks.
Well, I'm telling you to get it. The incident room had now fallen silent. Erica went on, and no one, I repeat, no one, is to talk to the press or share anything in any capacity. Do you hear me? I don't even want people saying no comment. Mouths shut.
Is that enough to keep you busy, DCI Sparks?
Yes, said Sparks, glaring at her.
And Crane, you'll get the incident room running smoothly?
Already on it,
he said, swallowing the last of his Mars bar.
Good, we'll reconvene here at 4.
Erica walked out, followed by Moss and Peterson. Sparks threw down his coat.
Bitch,
he said under his breath, and sat back down at his computer. Chapter 5. Moss peered over the steering wheel at the snowy road ahead. Erica sat beside her in the passenger seat, with Peterson in the back. The awkward silence was broken periodically by the windscreen wipers, hissing and squealing as they passed over the glass, and looking as if they were gummed up with grated coconut. South London was a palette of grimy greys. Decaying terraced houses slid past, their front gardens paved over for parking. The only dots of colour came from the wheelie bins packed outside in clusters of black, green and blue. The road turned sharply to the left, and they came to a halt at the back of a line of cars stretching around the first bend of the one-way Catford gyratory. Moss flicked on the siren, and the cars began to mount the pavement so they could pass. The heating in the squad car was broken, and it gave Erica a good excuse to keep her shaking hands deep in the pockets of her long leather jacket, hoping it was hunger making them shake, and not the pressure of the task ahead. She spied a packet of red licorice bootlaces tucked into the slot above the radio.
"Do you mind?" she asked, breaking the uneasy silence.
"Yeah, go ahead," said Moss.
She put her foot down, and they sped through a gap in the traffic, the back wheels lurching to one side on the icy road. Erica pulled a bootlace from the packet, pushed it into her mouth and chewed. She eyed Peterson in the rearview mirror. He was hunched intently over an iPad. He was tall and slight, with an oval, boyish face. He reminded her of a wooden toy soldier. He looked up and held her gaze.
"So, what can you tell me about Andrea Douglas Brown?" said Erica, swallowing the licorice bootlace and grabbing another.
"Didn't the super brief you, boss?"
asked Peterson.
"He did, but imagine he didn't. I approach every case from the point of knowing nothing. You'd be surprised what new insights come up."
"She's 23 years old," started Peterson.
"Did she work?"
"There's no employment history."
"Why?"
Peterson shrugged.
"Doesn't need to work. Lord Douglas Brown owns Samtech, a private defence company. They developed GPS and software systems for the government. At the last count, he was worth 30 million.
"Any brothers and sisters?" asked Erica.
"Yeah, she has a younger brother, David, and an older sister, Linda."
"So you could say Andrea and her siblings are trust fund kids?"
asked Erica.
"Yes and no. The sister, Linda, does work, albeit for her mother. Lady Douglas Brown owns a society, Florists. David is doing an MA at university."
They had now reached Catford High Street, which had been gritted, and the traffic was moving normally. They sped past pound shops, payday money lenders, and independent supermarkets with exotic produce piled high, threatening to spill over onto the slushy pavements.
"What about Andrea's fiancé, Giles Osborne?"
They were, due to have a big wedding in the summer," said Moss.
"What does he do?"
asked Erica.
"He runs an events company, upmarket stuff. Henley Regatta, product launches, society weddings."
"Did Andrea live with him?"
"No, she lives at home with the parents in Chiswick."
"That's West London, yeah?"
asked Erica. Peterson nodded at her in the rearview mirror. Moss went on.
You should see the family home. They've knocked four houses together, excavated the basement, must be worth millions.
They passed atop's tiles, which looked closed, its car park a large empty square of fresh snow, then a harvester restaurant, where a tall Christmas tree was being slowly fed into a chipper by a man wearing earmuffs. The drone of its engine vibrated through the car and then receded as a cluster of run-down pubs rolled into view. In front of one called the Stag, an old woman with a sunken face leant against a peeling green door, smoking a cigarette. Beside her, a dog had its head in a bin bag, the snowy pavement strewn with old food.
So what the hell was Andrea Douglas Brown doing around here alone?
Bit off the beaten track for the daughter of a millionaire who lives in Chiswick, isn't it?
Asked Erica. A flurry of snow briefly enveloped the car, and when it cleared, the Horniman Museum came into view. The sandstone edifice was flanked with tall yucca and palm trees, looking out of place caked in snow. Moss slowed the car at the iron gates, pulling up beside a young male uniformed officer. Erica wound down the window, and he leant down, placing a leather-gloved hand on the doorframe. Snow whirled into the car, sticking against the upholstered inside of the door. Erica showed him her ID.
"Take the next left. It's a steep hill. We've sent a gritter up there, but take it slow," he said.
Erica nodded and wound up the window. Moss took the left, and they started up the steep road. As they approached the summit, a roadblock came into view, manned by another uniformed officer. Standing on the pavement to the left of the police tape was a group of journalists, rugged up in winter gear. They took interest in the police car's arrival, and camera flashes bounced off the windscreen.
"Bugger off," growled Moss as she attempted to change up to third.
The gears crunched and the squad car lurched forward before stalling.
"Shit,"
she cried, gripping the wheel. She slammed on the brake, but they continued to slide. Through the rear-view mirror, Erica saw the road dropping away behind them. The photographers reacted to the drama and fired off more flashes.
"Do a sharp left now,"
shouted Peterson, quickly winding down his window and craning his neck round. Erica gripped the dashboard as Moss leaned into the wheel and managed to halt the slide, guiding the squad car into a recently vacated parking space by the curb, which was free of snow. The wheels caught on the bare tarmac, and they skidded to a stop in the parking space.
"That was sheer luck," said Peterson with a dry grin. Snow was pouring in through his window and sticking to his short dreadlocks.
"That was bloody sheer ice," said Moss, taking a deep breath.
Erica undid her belt, embarrassed to feel her legs shaking. They all exited the car as the photographers both jeered with laughter and called out questions about the identity of the dead body. Snow was rushing at them horizontally as they pulled out their ID, and the tape was lifted to let them pass. As Erica crossed underneath, she took comfort in being back, the police tape being lifted for her, the feel of the ID in her hand again. Another uniformed officer directed them towards the iron gate leading into the museum grounds. A huge white forensics tent now covered the boathouse, its base blurring into the mass of snow. One of the crime scene assistants was waiting with coveralls for Erica, Moss and Peterson, and they suited up before entering. Floodlights inside the tent gleamed off the snow and illuminated the rotting wood of the low roof. They peered underneath, where three forensics officers were assisting the crime scene manager, combing over every inch of the inside. A rowing boat sat gleaming on the small wooden jetty, and a police diver, slick in his black gear, emerged from the icy water with a spray, bringing with him a warm, bilious smell of stale pond. Rubbish and murk floated around him where chunks of ice were melting under the glare of the lights.
"DCI Foster,"
said a deep male voice. For once, Erica had to crane her head up to look at the tall figure that appeared from behind the boathouse. He pulled down his mask to reveal a proud, handsome face with large, dark eyes. His eyebrows were heavily plucked, resulting in two immaculate lines.
"I'm Isaac Strong, forensic pathologist," he said. "I know Moss and Peterson," he added.
They both nodded. He led them round past the outer wall of the boathouse, and they came to a metal stretcher placed lengthways against the back of the tent. The dead girl lay naked,
save for the remnants of a torn and muddy dress bunched around her waist. Below were the torn strips of a black thong. Her full lips were slightly parted, and one of her front teeth was broken off, close to the gum. Her eyes were wide open in a milky death stare, and her long hair was matted with leaves and debris from the water.
"That's her, isn't it?" said Erica quietly.
Moss and Peterson nodded.
"Okay," said Isaac, breaking the silence. "Her body was found frozen in the ice. At this early stage, I'd hazard, and I repeat, hazard, that she'd been in the water for at least 72 hours. The temperature dropped below zero 3 days ago. Also, her phone was still working when she was found. A young guy who works here heard it ringing."
He handed Erica an iPhone, bagged up in clear plastic. It had a spray of Swarovski crystals on the cover.
"Do we know who was ringing?" asked Erica, seizing the thought of an early lead.
"No. The battery died shortly after we retrieved it from the water. It's been dusted for prints, but it's a mess."
"Where's the guy who found her?"
"The paramedics are with him in an ambulance by the visitor's center. He was in a state when uniform arrived on the scene. He'd fallen through the ice on top of the body, vomited, urinated, and defecated in shock. So we're trying to eliminate his DNA fast," said Isaac.
He moved to the body on the stretcher.
"Bloating of the face and ligature marks on the neck could indicate strangulation, and her right collarbone is broken," he said,
and gently used a latex-gloved hand to tilt the head.
"Clumps of hair are missing, roughly around the same patch by each temple."
"Whoever did it could have been behind her and pulled at her hair," said Moss.
"Is there evidence of sexual violence?" asked Erica.
"I'll need time to look further. There are wheels and scratches on her inner thighs, ribs and breasts."
He indicated a bloom of red lines under each breast, and carefully placed his hand over to show the imprint of fingers on her rib cage.
"The wrists are lacerated, which could indicate her hands were tied. But her arms weren't tied when she went into the water. There is also bruising to the back of the head, and we found fragments of tooth enamel embedded in the front corner post of the jetty."
"We're still looking for the remains of the tooth. She could have swallowed it, so I may find it later."
"When she went missing, she was wearing pink high heels and had a pink bag. Any sign of those?" asked Moss.
"She was only wearing the dress and underwear, but no bra, no shoes."
Isaac carefully lifted her legs. "The heels of her feet are badly lacerated."
"Dragged barefoot," said Erica, recoiling at the sight of her feet, angrily scraped and split, the flesh underneath pink.
"One of our divers did pull this out of the water."
Isaac handed Erica a small clear plastic bag.
It contained a driving license ID card.
They regarded the photo, silent for a moment.
"That's an intense photo. It's like she's there, staring at us from beyond the grave," said Peterson.
Erica thought he was right. Often in ID pictures, the eyes were glazed over, or the subject looked a little trapped in the headlights, but Andrea had a confident stare.
"Jesus,"
said Erica, looking from the photo of Andrea to the dead body, wide-eyed and filthy on the stretcher.
"How soon can you establish an exact cause of death?" "I've given you enough to go on. I'll need to do the autopsy,"
bristled Isaac.
"Which you'll do today,"
said Erica, fixing him with a stare.
"Yes, today," said Isaac.
The grounds were quiet outside the forensics tent. The snow had stopped falling, and a group of uniformed officers were silently combing their way around the lake, white bunching up around their dark legs as they waded through the drifts of snow. Erica took out her phone and called Marsh.
"Sir, it's Andrea Douglas Brown," she said.
There was a pause.
"Shit. I'm just on my way to talk to the boy who found her, and then I'll go and inform the parents," said Erica.
"Your thoughts, Foster?"
"Without a doubt, we're looking at murder, perhaps rape with strangulation or drowning. Everything I have is on its way to the guys back at the Nick. Do we have any suspects in view?"
"No, sir, I'm hitting the ground running as it is. We need to organize a formal ID with the family. Forensics are going straight from the scene to do an autopsy, so I'll keep you posted on the arrangements for that."
"If I can tell the media we have a suspect," started Marsh.
"Yes, sir, I know. Talking to the family is our first line of inquiry. There's a high chance she knew the killer. When she went missing, there were no witnesses. No one saw her being snatched. She could have met the killer here."
Take it easy, Foster. Don't go in guns blazing, assuming that Andrea was meeting up for some sordid shag.
I never said she was meeting for a sordid... Remember, this is a well-respected family who...
I have done this before, sir.
Yes, but realise who you're dealing with.
Yes, a grieving family, and I have to ask them the usual question, sir.
Yes, but this is an order. Go easy.
When Erica came off the phone, she was prickling at Marsh's attitude. The one thing she despised about Britain was its class system. Even in a murder investigation, it seemed that Marsh wanted the family to have some kind of VIP treatment. Moss and Peterson emerged from the tent with a uniformed police officer, and they made their way past the lake and through the sunken garden. Erica wondered if the blank-eyed statues had watched as Andrea was dragged past, screaming for her life. A radio on the accompanying officer's lapel hissed static.
"We've just recovered a small pink handbag from a hedge on London Road," said a tinny voice.
"Which direction is London Road?" asked Erica.
"The High Street,"
said the officer, pointing past a row of trees. After months of inactivity, Erica was struggling to get her brain back into gear. Every time she closed her eyes, she saw Andrea's body, skin torn and bruised, blank eyes wide open. There were so many variables to a murder investigation. The average-sized house could keep a forensics team busy for days, but this was a crime scene potentially stretching across 17 acres, with evidence strewn across public areas, trapped under a thick layer of snow.
"Bring it to the visitor centre by the ambulance," said Erica to the officer, who hurried off.
Moments later, she, Moss and Peterson emerged from the hedgerows. At the bottom of a gentle snow-covered slope was the futuristic glass box of the visitor's centre. A courtyard out front had been churned up by an ambulance, which was parked with its back doors open. A young man in his early 20s sat in the back under a pile of blankets. He was grey-faced and shaking. A small woman stood by the ambulance doors, watching over a member of the crime scene unit who was carefully processing the boy's clothes, his gloved hand labelling the soiled tracksuit, jumper and trainers in their clear evidence bags. The woman had the same bushy eyebrows as the boy, but with a sharp little face.
"I want a receipt," she was saying, "and I want it in writing what's being taken away. Leonie got those tracksuit bottoms in November, and those trainers are new too. There's still 13 weeks of catalogue payments to be made on them. How long are you going to have them for?"
"These are all now evidence in a murder investigation," said Erica as they reached the ambulance. "I'm DCI Foster. This is Detective Moss and Detective Peterson." They held out their ID and the woman peered beadily at their photos.
"What's your name?" prompted Erica.
"Grace Kinney, and Marley's done nothing more than turn up for work. And because he's been forced to wait in the cold, he'll be on the sick and they'll stop his money."
"Lee, can you tell us exactly what happened?"
Lee nodded, his face pale and haunted. He told them how he'd arrived for work, then followed the sound of the phone ringing, which had led to the discovery of Andrea's body under the ice. An officer interrupted him, appearing at the ambulance doors, holding a small pink clutch bag in a clear plastic bag. Another plastic bag contained its contents: 6 £50 notes, 2 compact tampons, a mascara, a lipstick, and a perfume atomizer.
"Did that belong to the dead girl?"
said Grace, peering over. The officer quickly placed it behind his back.
"She's seen it now," Erica snapped at the officer.
She went on, "Miss Kinney, you have to understand that this is evidence in a sensitive investigation and..."
"I'll keep my mouth shut, don't you worry,"
Grace said. "Although what a young girl with a designer bag and a wad of 50s is doing round here, God only knows."
"What do you think she was doing?" asked Erica.
"I'm not doing your job for you, but it don't take Sherlock Holmes to realise she was on the game. She probably brought a punter up here and it all went wrong,"
said Grace. "Lee, did you recognise the dead girl?"
"Why would my Lee recognise a prostitute?"
We don't think she was a prostitute."
Grace seemed oblivious to Lee's distress. He pulled the blanket around him and furrowed his brow, knitting his bushy eyebrows together.
"She was beautiful," he said quietly. "Even dead under the ice. It was horrible how she died, wasn't it?"
Erica nodded.
"I could see it in her face," said Lee.
"Sorry, what was the question?" Did you recognise her, Lee? Have you seen her around? Repeated Erica.
No, I've never seen her before, he said.
We think she could have been out at one of the pubs on the high street when she went missing. Which pubs attract the younger crowd? Asked Peterson.
Lee shrugged. The Weatherspoon's busy on a weekend, Pig and Whistle, that's just up from the station.
Do you go out much, Lee? Asked Peterson.
Lee shrugged.
Peterson continued, The Weatherspoon's, the Pig and Whistle, any other pubs?
East steers clear of those, don't you?